Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm joined by my friend and confidant, Chris Sherman. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Aaron. How's it going?
Hey, it is awesome having you here. You were the guest on the 7th episode of Sourcing Matters, now coming in for a first time as co-host. What's the expectation for today?
It feels a little bit like going back to your college for alumni weekend. It's exciting. It's a little scary, but having been also a fan of the show, I am psyched to be here.
Well, very good. We'll try not to have too much of the beer dye tables out later on, but we'll do our best.
No guarantees.
Hey, Chris, a little bit about your background. Chris Sherman is the president of Island Creek Oysters, focused on promoting the many values that shellfish bring to humans, the ocean, and the planet. Chris and his team have built a brand known for global excellence. As a pioneer in regenerative ocean farming, Island Creek Oysters has established a sustainable model for sustenance and jobs in their community in Massachusetts. Levering his ocean smarts to do greater good, Chris also curates the Island Creek Oysters Foundation, a nonprofit which codifies the replicable models of aquaculture for the developing world. That's fantastic stuff, Chris. Additionally, Chris is a 2018 Eisenhower Fellow. As part of his program to Spain and Colombia, Chris assessed capacity building and innovative financing models for the future of biomimetic aquaculture. Some might say, Chris, you're one bad mother shucka.
I wish that was the first time I've been called that.
I know, that's right. Well, maybe this will be the first time. So watch your mouth. I'm talking about Chris Sherman, right? Is the chef, cue the chef sound.
I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah, he does what he can for his fellow oyster man, right? How's that?
I like it.
I'll see if I can get the licensing rights for the chef track and we'll put that on there.
You heard it here first, folks.
Hey, well, thanks for joining. Appreciate it. Chris, according to the United Nations FAO estimates, there are 1.2 billion folks employed in global agriculture and another 200 million in fisheries throughout the planet. Now, depending on where you live, there's a vast disparity of employment in food production. For instance, in Thailand, 30+% of the population is employed in agriculture. In Pakistan, it's 42% that produce our food. And in Uganda, it's 71% of the population. On the adverse side, in the U.S., it's 0.7%. Not even 1% are involved in agriculture, fisheries, and they actually throw in forestry in that. But we've come to realize that this V1 of automation in food and its production have come with some externalities that are maybe now being realized that they have impact on the environment, on our co-inhabitants, and on our health. Well, maybe it's good at creating calories, but at what cost to our shared health? And we may be good at finding more fish with a modern tech, but at what cost of fisheries for tomorrow as well? Gets you wonder if automation and technological advancements in food have to come with sacrifices in systems health. Or does it depend on what tasks we're asking technology to partake in? Or for what purpose, for that matter? Like refined ecological systems have done, can we improve in our next iteration of tech? Can we become more efficient in reducing waste and getting rid of the excessive externalities that will be better in marrying us with planetary boundaries and systems that were harmonized well before our involvement? So, Chris, in my book, your oyster farms are one of the best examples of investing in the betterment of ecological systems for economic benefit. So how do you balance that technology and automation within the constraints of natural order, your industry regulations, and evolving consumer interests?
Yeah, there's a lot there, Aaron. I think the conversation is particularly apropos to food production and even more so to aquaculture, globally conceived. We're lucky, and as you mentioned, we farm a product, an animal, that is actually a source of protein and a net benefit to the environment where it's grown. So we got very lucky. We think about other sources of protein like livestock, finfish having perhaps even bigger impact than shellfish as far as the market value and the number of consumers globally, and the kind of potential for fallout, the potential for positive value creation is even larger in those contexts. And if you think about food production, the fascinating thing about it is you have a giant spectrum of participants. So you have publicly traded companies, multi-billion dollar privately held companies that are engaged in food production at a very high level or in supply chain or any sort of ancillary business around it. And then on the other end of the food system, you've got smallhold producers in the developing world that are really the polar opposite. And there are very few industries, you know, left on the planet that have that that whole spectrum. So when we think about the way automation has an impact within that type of ecosystem, it's perhaps even more complex and to me more interesting than a number of other contexts. So two specific examples with aquaculture. One is that you mentioned our foundation. We are harnessing the power of aquaculture, the ability to efficiently create protein through fish to have positive social and economic impact in the developing world. So we work in Haiti, we work in Africa, and we are actively engaged in creating jobs for people who don't have them. And oftentimes when you think about automation, it's about, you know, people's knee-jerk reaction. And I think probably a good place to discuss today is that you're eliminating jobs. And while I don't think that's necessarily the case, it is something that we confront head on in a place like Haiti. On the other end of the spectrum, you have major closed system farms, what we say in the industry is RAS, or recirculating aquaculture technology. And these are attracting multi-million dollar institutional investments. They have a very heavy technology play. They've kind of removed the environment from the equation, and they depend very heavily on fairly cost-effective, but highly, you know, very high-quality automation and instrumentation to run these operations. So in a way, the very existence of this incredibly this incredibly high potential technology depends on the technology that underlies it is automation and kind of robotics. So when we think about applying, you know, automation in the aquaculture context, it's a complicated complicated scenario. And I think there is tremendous opportunity to move the ball forward with aquaculture and food systems, but also we have to be very careful about the impact on the farmers themselves, the growers, and the kind of socioeconomic systems in which they operate.
Good stuff, Chris, and that does a nice job of queuing us up for our conversation today, as you mentioned. Today, we're welcoming an expert in the field of automation and technological disruption. Today, we welcome Kathleen Kennedy, who is the Executive Director of the MIT Center of Collective Intelligence. Hey, Kathleen, how you doing?
I'm fine, Aaron. How are you?
It's wonderful seeing you again. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and share some thoughts with us. My first question for you, and I know agriculture and food is not your expertise. I know you have interest in it, and I know that you work on other areas of disruption and automation. But first question I'm going to ask is tech and automation going to disrupt the world of agriculture? Is it going to take everybody's jobs like everyone's concerned with in food systems?
That's a huge question. So first of all, I'm not a huge expert on automation. I'm more of an expert around the people and machines working together. So it's really that intersection where I play. I'm not a roboticist, although I do know many at MIT. From the perspective of whether or not it's going to take all the jobs, I think that not for a long time. And if we think about how many different industries have been disrupted over time, often jobs are eliminated, but usually many, many, many more are created. So I think that that's the first thing that we think about. Secondly, thinking about AI and automation taking away jobs, we think about that that's something that's been coming and talked about for a very long time, that AI is going to transform everything. We had actually some students graph that at MIT and found that ever since the dawn of AI in the early 50s, that has been posed that in about 20 years, we would reach generalized AI. So that means, so let me, do you want me to define that for you?
Please, if you would.
Wonderful. So we think about artificial intelligence. Think about specialized intelligence and generalized intelligence. Now, specialized intelligence is where we are right now. So let's use Watson, for instance. So we all remember the famous when Watson the computer played Jeopardy and beat the best Jeopardy player in the world. Well, that same program could not play chess. That same program would not be able to do this radio show here today with Chris. So it could do one very specialized thing. Now, generalized intelligence is where actually you were talking about getting to, where generalized intelligence could be able to replace a human. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're in the world where it's thinking about how do people and machines work together more effectively? How can machines actually augment human work? And that's really the place where we play.
Let me read a bit about your background here, and then we'll continue with this line of questioning. Kathleen Kennedy currently serves as the executive director of the MIT Center of Collective Intelligence, as mentioned. In addition, she is a venture partner at the Good Growth Capital and serves on the board of Hubweek. Prior, Kathleen served the lead organizer of The Engine, an MIT initiative created to advance innovation. This venture fund and accelerator program opened in spring of 2017 and was created to provide a comprehensive support to transformative ideas from the formative stage to the most effective implementation. Kathleen is a frequent speaker at technology and entrepreneurship events around the world. She's very active in the community, serving as a judge for many competitions, including the MacArthur Foundation, an inclusive innovation competition, and the, is it Lemelson MIT Prizes? She was awarded the Folio 40, which recognizes the most innovative and influential people in the media industry, and named by women of the Harvard Club as one of Boston's most influential women in 2017. Well, look at that. That's really impressive stuff. Chris, we can just let her talk. We're done. No more for us. It's good. That's amazing.
This is easy.
Easy.
From here on out, it's downhill. Cat's got it.
Kathleen, tell us a little bit more about some of the projects you're now working at or on at Collective Intelligence, if you would.
Of course, the Center for Collective Intelligence. So the center's been around since 2006, and I joined it last year. And what my focus on is taking the 12 years of research, the foundation of the research that they've been working on in collective intelligence, thinking about how groups of people work together more intelligently, how that intelligence can be measured, how can we think about making groups of people more effective, but most importantly, how do we pair people and machines to work together to do things they've never been able to do before and do them more intelligently. So that's the work that we do. We have a number of different places of research. We have a guy called Peter Glore who works on a thing called the happy meter. So Chris, you might want to think about this with all of your employees. How do you actually measure them being more happy and obviously then usually being more effective? We have a number of other researchers. One is a guy called Mark Klein, who's doing something called the deliberatorium. This is around thinking about trust online and how do you actually have fair debate. And so he's been looking at ways to measure that. And one area that he's focused on a lot about is in newspapers, in thinking about how do you have debate between people around specific stories and facts. Another area, then taking a lot of this research that we've been focused on, and we are looking at how do we apply that to industry? How do we apply that to the real world and real world challenges? And so we're working with governments and cities around the world, as well as large corporations, on addressing big challenges.
Interesting, as we now look at some of the biggest challenges facing humanity and us now trying to integrate these conversations around ways of codifying resolutions and solutions of change. One of those things is the UN's SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. Have you worked on some of the projects that take those implementations on a technology and computer side and combine it with implementation for the people involved in that?
That was called a softball.
That is a softball.
Thank you very much, Aaron. So one of the first projects that the center did was called the Climate Collab. And so what the researchers wanted to do was think about how do you harness collective intelligence to solve big challenges. So let me back up a little bit and talk about collective intelligence in thinking about the web has connected people all around the world. So that's one example of people and machines working together that have allowed them to be more intelligent and work more effectively than ever before. Wikipedia is an excellent example in thinking about that is harnessing people working collectively together to actually build an encyclopedia. Who used that today? Most people, well, except Chris didn't have his phone today.
I did use it, actually.
See, there you go. So it's something that people use every day. And so that's the idea of actually reimagining what knowledge is and how it's produced. So thinking, we thought, okay, that's really interesting. How do we think about, how do you harness people and machines and this hyperconnectivity in a way that you can address a big challenge? What's a big challenge? Climate change. That's a really big one. So the researchers then basically created a whole catalog of all the challenges, broke it down into a whole logic structure, and then created different challenge areas. And so for the last, since 2009, so last 10 years, the Climate CoLab has been working on collectively finding solutions for climate change. How can anyone in the world participate in contributing solutions?
What I would love to know more about, too, as we get into all of those data points coming in for all of those assessments around the world, looking at what's happening with climate change. And, Chris, we see it with acidification in the ocean and how it can be microclimates or vast integration. Do we use computers to make the analysis and assess that as far as the data aggregation, and then people still use that general intelligence to make judgments of what to do about that? Is that where we're at with this collective intelligence?
Yes. Let's see. So thinking about, I can talk a little bit more about the project itself. Yeah. Not necessarily relating as much to the specialized and generalized, although that was a nice bridge there. So I would say that we do contests every year, and what we're looking at building it up to is thinking about a contest web where you think about a problem on a local level, and then you think about how those solutions at a local level could be pulled together to actually create regional and national solutions that actually could be rolled up to a global solution. So it's more how do you think about and then linking them to the SDGs. So it's really thinking about how do you think about the whole system and how do we improve all of the systems that we have, utilizing the input of people together to make that work.
I love it. It's the solutions of change. Chris, you had a question.
It is. It's, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about in the agriculture and aquaculture world around that I think applies to this issue in a larger global issue is immigration. Mm-hmm. You think a lot about the movement of labor around the world, and a lot of it is driven by conflict and by, economic powers. However, some of it is also intimately linked with food production. So there's an acquaintance of mine, Kevin Murphy, who's the former CEO of Driscoll's Berries. He actually just had a recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And as he's moved on from Driscoll's, he's really taken up as his cause celeb this issue of immigration. And inevitably, in that conversation, the question of automation of labor comes up. And he's a great example because if you think about Driscoll's, it's a high-quality berry company. They produce everything from blueberries to blackberries to strawberries. And a lot of the harvest is done by migrant workers who are in the U.S. in particular. Some of their main production is in California in the kind of the salad bowl. And some of those workers are resident workers who are here illegally. Some of them are people who come over on the new visa program. But they're also simultaneously, as they're working on immigration issues, they're working quite a bit on automation. But they use the example of a raspberry. And they can't quite come up with a machine that could pick a raspberry without kind of destroying it. And that's where the train comes off the tracks. So when I think about automation, I think about, okay, how do we harness collective intelligence or some type of robotics or instrumentation to not only tackle the small problem of how do you pick the raspberry, but in so doing, attack the big problem of how do we help this global issue of people moving around the world in a way that can be disruptive or challenging? And so I wonder, in this larger conversation, Kathleen, is there, you know, is there something in your work that points to, you know, the kind of the specific development of technology to do simple tasks, for instance, everyday domestic tasks or tasks that being done by, you know, low-skilled labor? And do you see that kind of feeding up to a larger cause at a global level?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of things there. Let me start with just on Friday, I went over and visited the Toyota Robotics R&D lab, which is over in Kendall Square. And there was a number of researchers that were doing some really cool stuff. So two things that you just said with the Raspberry point. One guy was doing, he talked about hands and how hands work and how our human hands are such amazing tools that they're, and one of the key things about them is that they're actually soft and they can bend in so many different ways. But the fact that they're soft is a really interesting thing. So he's been working on thinking about how do you pick up things without crushing them. So that exact thing. So Toyota's really thinking about that. The second thing that they were thinking about was how do you load and unload a dishwasher? And so how are machines actually doing these simple household tasks? Now, one of the big things about that was not just the idea that they were unloading and loading the dishwasher. Toyota, I don't think, is really looking into that line of business. But what they were thinking about was from the perspective of the training data. And so that's what you're seeing a lot in this AI and robotics, that it's really about getting the training data, getting those huge sets so that you'll be able to train these machines to do these types of things. So that's a giant geopolitical issue. And so I've done a lot of travel throughout the world and talking about just that, how are European countries dealing with this giant migration issue? How is Venezuela and Colombia dealing with a lot of the issues that they're dealing with? So we've been looking at ways to harness collective intelligence to apply it to a place like Venezuela. How do you think about how do you deal with that debt? How do you think about how do you change that government and think about that? So cryptocurrency is one aspect of the way things can be done and thinking about new ways of changing economies. There's a lot of different ways of doing banking with mobile devices and thinking about you don't have to. One of the big issues with immigration is that they don't actually have the papers that they need to be able to get bank accounts in their new countries. And so without being able to do that, you can't actually sort of live in a normal way. So I worked with a startup that was looking at harnessing different ways of doing crypto, different ways of doing collective intelligence so that you could verify that someone is someone. So there's a lot of really interesting work being done in the financial realm thinking about that. Another really cool project that we're working on is with JP Morgan and looking at the new way of doing a prediction economy. And that's sort of thinking about part of what you were talking about is thinking about what would be really interesting for you, Chris, is how do you think about predicting food supply? How do you think about predicting demand? How do you think about predicting where people are going to want certain things so that you can have the right amounts in different places? So it's a whole new way of harnessing collective intelligence to think about how do we massively bring down the cost of prediction, which right now is quite expensive. I'm sure, as you know, data analytics and different things like that and getting good talent to do that is quite expensive. But how do you think about actually having ubiquitous prediction? How would that change your whole business?
Being in the food industry, you know, my mind immediately goes to food waste, which is really an allocation issue, which leads in turn to food access, which is a major problem and the major driver of hunger and malnutrition in the world. So being able to harness this technology and its incredible ability to kind of do quantifiable math on a giant scale is really, really compelling. Even as we think about our biggest challenge on a day-to-day basis from a distribution standpoint is trying to buy enough product and grow enough product and harvest enough product and marry that with demand so at the end of the day we don't have a bunch of perishable seafood sitting in our cooler. The ability to do that is huge, and I'm sure there's larger implications in merchandising for companies like Amazon to J. Crew, you know, you name it. So that's pretty compelling. I think another question I have too, and just to throw one more in here, one of the things you mentioned, Kathleen, is thinking about using collective intelligence and artificial intelligence to judge, for instance, fairness of online debate. And there are two very different things from, you think about a kind of giant computer doing incredible math to predict, you know, merchandising trends or food demand. And then you think about a machine getting into kind of making these decisions that value, that border on kind of value judgments. And I just heard a piece on the way in here actually on the use of facial recognition technology in China to detect if someone's lying or if they're potentially qualified for a job or not. And I wonder if you could elaborate on just some of that crossover and where do we stand currently with the technology we have access to in that kind of equation of there's things that you think of naturally a machine doing, and there's things that are very human that machines are now potentially developing the capability of making those decisions.
Sure. So we think a lot about decision-making, period. And so let me actually take a step back and let's actually talk about the mechanics of making a decision. So what we would say is that that's the cognitive process. So the cognitive process of making a decision are you sense a number of options. Then you tend to remember what you've seen in the past. So it's sort of thinking about pattern recognition. And then you sense what is around you. And then, based on all of those inputs and what your options are, you make a decision, and then you act. And then once you act, you learn from what happened, and that goes back and that goes into your memory, and you go on. And you make how many hundreds, thousands of decisions every day. And so that's thinking about decision making. Now, let's think about all of that right now is done individually. You do that as a group. And you think about how groups make decisions. So we think about how groups make decisions. We think about different types of groups and how decisions making is made. Now, one of the professors I work with is a guy called Thomas Malone, and he wrote a book called Superminds. And so what we think about is superminds. How do superminds make decisions? Superminds are groups of people and machines, or anything really, that work together to make decisions. So let me talk to you about a couple different types of superminds. One would be a hierarchy. Everyone knows what a hierarchy. Chris is the president, so he's at sort of the top of a hierarchy of a number of different people that you make decisions, and people below you implement those decisions. And then probably line managers and different people make different decisions that people below them make decisions. So that's how a hierarchy works. A democracy, decisions are made by voting. So individuals vote, and in a representative democracy, we all give our votes to different people that we vote for. So thinking about this is sort of decision-making process. Now let's think about how these different types of superminds and that cognitive process, machines get fit into that. So thinking about how a machine can be like the manager of a group of people in a hierarchy. So you can actually think about replacing that, and then you think about how that cognitive process works with a machine. You can think about a machine can be a peer. So one day, Aaron, you could be replaced by a machine, and we could be sitting across from a AI that does exactly what you're doing.
Ready for vacation. Yeah, give me a long vacation.
Permanent vacation. Exactly. But so when you think about that, in fact, here's an example that, Chris, you were in your car when you were driving over here. You were dealing with a machine that was your manager. A traffic light is a machine that is a manager. There used to be guys that directed traffic, but now it is a traffic light, and that is a machine that actually manages groups of people and machines working together.
fascinating. And as we talked about this, we've mentioned things like labor, immigration, fairness of debate, fraud, mechanisms of making decision, groups making decision as a collective supermind, and predictive analysis. It goes right to a 2020 election. Are we going to see collective intelligence, the center of collective intelligence, involved in what's going to happen with our presidential elections in 2020?
Probably.
We'll leave that as a to be continued, right? We'll go back for a second episode of that. Okay. No problem. We'll come back to that later on. Let me read a bit more, because you have a background in media, and you spent 16 years at the MIT Technology Review, including serving as the president. And Kathleen Kennedy helped redefine the magazine brand and expand the global footprint, developing international programs and producing world-class events. She served for 6 years as the president of the MIT Enterprise Forum and global network of chapters organized around entrepreneurship. You also are involved, as I mentioned in the initial introduction, with the Hub Week. And you were involved, Chris, in Hub Week last year. And Hub Week is an initiative that is based out of putting creative minds together, making the impact of art and science and technology. It's a collaboration amongst Harvard University, MIT, Massachusetts General Hospital, as well as the Boston Globe. Chris, you spoke at last year's festivities, right? And could you tell us a bit about your experience with doing that? And then, Ken, I'm going to come back to you about what that means on the media side and how disruption has played in there.
Sure. For me, it was really a great experience, because it was an incredible, and I think the first time in my life here in Boston, which has been my entire life, that we were able to take kind of the new Boston that's emerged over the last 20 years as not only a center for thought and education, but also a kind of global center for innovation, and bring it all together in one kind of place. And Kathleen did an incredible job kind of convening not only incredible people from the educational institutions that are here, like MIT and Harvard, but also from the industries like biotech and pharma and then the investment community behind them, but also bringing in people like myself who are from some of the older industries here, like seafood and shipping and kind of the blue economy that this whole seaboard was kind of built on. So it was an incredible opportunity to go and participate in that and kind of be a part of that group, because the conversations that were had were really unique. And I think that Hub Week and seeing its impact around the greater Boston community and just starting that type of conversation has had a lasting effect well beyond just the kind of week in which it exists. So I was really thankful to be a part of it.
Can I pick up on that?
Please.
So Chris, thanks for the nice lead there, because this year, Hub Week, we're celebrating our fifth anniversary, and we're doing just that. We're realizing that we don't want to be just cordoned off into 1 week, but we're actually going to have a year-long engagement. So we're doing a number of different things that we're really excited about. First of all, we've got our Ideas Festival that is actually on October 1st through 3rd. And just like you said, sort of thinking about this new Boston, we're moving it away from City Hall and we're bringing it down to the Seaport. So that's going to be really cool, that sort of that block around the water and the ICA and their district hall and the Envoy and the Grand. So we're going to be utilizing all those new spaces down there. And the foot traffic down there is amazing. I think it was something like 45,000 people like walk by on a daily basis around that neighborhood. So really cool stuff happening there. Then we're doing what we're calling open doors. So we're bringing sort of the innovation economy to different neighborhoods around the city and celebrating that for a day. So actually this week was on Monday, it was Roxbury. And then next month in July, on July 10th, we're taking it down to Kendall Square and really sort of going into the different places in Kendall Square and seeing where the future is being created. So we're really excited about Hub Week.
Let's go back those 5 years, because you just come out, or you're still working at 16 years at the MIT Technology Review in the media space. What was the impetus for starting HubWeek? Is it the fact that Boston always punches way above its fighting weight, and here's an opportunity to continue to cast us as a much larger shadow around the world, and how to pull that under one roof? Is that the objective?
Yeah, I think the point was that the idea that the future is really being created here, and sort of something that Chris alluded to before, is that Boston has sort of been a bit of marketing has not been its prime strength. It was more, we're just going to build stuff and it's just great. And so I think a number of people came together and said, you know, hey, we really want to be capturing more. We don't want to be losing this brain drain fight, and we want to be capturing more of our talent here and really, you know, celebrating what we're doing. And then I think the second thing about HubWeek that's really interesting is it's that we found a lot of the interesting things that are happening are at the intersections. So it's really sort of the intersection of art, science, technology, and design. That's where we saw some interesting leverage points. And we wanted to celebrate that and celebrate this new economy. So it's interesting. I've only lived in Boston for 20 years. So I've been here the whole time of this new Boston. But a lot of people tell me about that there was a more of an old Boston that wasn't embracing this quite as well.
What can we expect to see from the Center of Collective Intelligence under your leadership moving forward in the next few years, aside from possible work with the 2020 elections?
No comment on the 2020 elections. On the Center for Collective Intelligence, we've got two major initiatives that I'm excited about. One is we're building a design lab on looking at how do we harness the frameworks that we're building from the Superminds book, and looking at how do new organizations harness technology to solve big challenges. So that's number one, and we're working with a number of different organizations on some cool projects. And then the second one is the prediction economy and building a consortium around that on setting the standards and how can that become a reality.
Chris, where do you see, in listening to Kat now and learning here for the last 45 minutes about where this intersection of machine and human can take place, any initial thoughts come to mind in your industry, in the fisheries and oyster production that can be integrated?
Sure. The big question for me, I think, circles back to the beginning of the show and thinking about different contexts. One, in the kind of the obvious ways that it can have a major impact with some of these heavily funded, very advanced technology projects. But also, Kathleen, to your point about technology working with people to kind of enhance people's productivity, you know, thinking about how that gets deployed for the multitude, the vast majority of people who are involved in food production in the world, who aren't working for, you know, a firm that's been funded from Wall Street or London or Stockholm, but who are working for potentially themselves or for some less responsible organization, you know, how does that kind of manifest in a way that it's enhancing people's lives all over the kind of, at all levels of the pyramid?
Great. So that actually is another project that we're working on with the Superminds Design Lab. We're looking at creating a design library and looking at how organizations all around the world are harnessing technology coupled with people to solve a challenge. So thinking about what we're talking about doing, how do you actually architect that? How do you break down the process in thinking about how do you use machines and people together? So we can go back to the Wikipedia example of, if you want to create a new type of encyclopedia, how would you do it today? So that's one example. There's another one called the Human Diagnosis Project that's thinking about how do you actually couple machines and doctors together to think about diagnosing diseases in a new way, that it's constantly building on what they learn every day. I think in the food industry, there's going to be a lot of different areas, not only in automation, in every space of the way. I know you probably already know about it, but Spice, I think downtown in Boston, is looking at automation where it took all of the people out of the kitchen. And so you're just having people deal with the customers and machines make the food.
I do like the idea of people with people skills utilizing them on a regular basis. That's, you know, our philosophy as a business and a brand is to couple, you know, innovation in production and distribution, and kind of our mission of kind of growing aquaculture's presence in our food systems with a really strong hospitality experience and a human element. And I think we're strong believers in that's the best way to get anything done, is to have people engage with people. So that's very good, very nice to hear.
Kathleen, where can our listening audience learn more about what you're up to at the Center of Collective Intelligence? Is the website the best location?
I'd say the website's the best location, yeah.
Okay, I'll include a link. Is there a place that they can see some of these projects and maybe read case studies or videos? Is it well documented on there, or is it more to come?
Well, absolutely. And then I'd say our other would be the Superminds MIT Twitter feed, and then the Climate Collab, at Climate Collab.
Which will definitely be an engagement point for a lot of our listeners on the Collab side. I'll just close by repeating some of the things that you had mentioned. First, I'll say during your keynote you gave in 2017 in Krakow, Poland, you mentioned that at MIT, we don't fear disruption, we drive it. And I thought that was a nice saying that will resonate with a lot of people because, as you mentioned, you know, more jobs can be created from disruption. And that intersection where things are happening is the place of interest. That's the place to be. And it seems like Boston, through some of the work that you've been involved in and cultivating through Hub Week, is continually to be that. And with new projects like the Superminds Design Lab and Ideas Festivals and Innovation Economies that you're continuing to foster, you're making Boston a better place and a global player. All right here, Chris, right in front of us. This is unbelievable. I feel like we've gone through this modern history of Boston. It's pretty exciting.
Even us in the food business can benefit greatly from people like Kathleen.
And we benefit greatly from Chris.
Absolutely. Yes, we do. And I'll just say, as it sounds like eventually, even though we're currently at the specialized intelligence, soon to get to the generalized intelligence, I'll be able to go on more vacations and you guys can talk to a computer here named Hal, maybe. I don't know, something like that, right? That's the old joke, I'm sure. So, well, I appreciate you taking the time to come in today. It was a wonderful conversation. Always great seeing you. So I learned a great deal. Chris?
I learned quite a bit. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Kat. Appreciate you taking the time.
Great. Enjoyed it, guys. Thanks a million.